Is it Bauer?
Yeah, Bauer. B-A-U-E-R.
Oh, you're right. Okay, good deal. All right. Okay, we got Chad Bauer here. Chad, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Steve and Cody, for having me on.
So the way we got to hear from Chad was he attacked us online about the Sunday hunting. And then the orange thing. Go ahead, explain your, just before we even get into anything, explain your theory behind that.
Wait a minute. No, I'm just going to, on his defense, it was a, I believe that was the night we had like four or five. We had three or four guys were here with us. And we went around the room and asked opinions of whether we thought that Sunday hunting or the Saturday opening day was a good thing, whether you were for it or against it. Yep. And I believe everybody but yourself was against it, but was pro Sunday hunting. And
yes.
I think. So I'll need now to, Chad, you can make a comment that you made, because I get it. Like, at first I didn't get it, but I get it now. I completely understand where the perspective.
And I'm just getting on Chad's.
Yeah, we're just dragging a little move.
So go ahead. Explain your theory there. You're thinking about it.
Okay, yeah, and it was a verbal assault, believe me. I was dropping word cannons.
Yeah.
But, I always hear hunters say that they like the tradition of the Monday first day, the Monday opening day of deer season in Pennsylvania. So when the game commission wanted to change that to a Saturday opening day, they don't like that. It's going to ruin tradition. People are going to have to leave their or go to their camps on Friday so they can get everything set up, and it's just going to ruin tradition. But then the topic of Sunday hunting came involved. And every hunter I know says, let's Sunday hunt. Why not Sunday hunt? It'd make everything so much better. Let's Sunday hunt. But what happened to the tradition of no Sunday hunting? I just think it's a double standard. And that's coming strictly from a non-hunter that I fish a lot, and I'm in the woods a lot, but I'm not a hunter. So that's just my opinion.
I can respect that.
Oh, I can too, and I can also respect the fact that.
And he's right.
You can't bitch about. We were bitching about not having extra days to hunt. Well, all of a sudden now they're throwing us an extra day to hunt, and everybody's getting pissed off about it. Like,
I
don't want to go out on Saturday, and I'm just as guilty.
It's completely contradictory.
But it is, and I'll take that extra day to hunt. But I still like to see that Southern coming pissed off of it.
Oh, and believe me, if I was archery hunting, I would love to have Sundays free so I could go out in the woods and stick a buck, you know? But I'm not, so I want the woods to myself.
Well, and on the other hand, we got into this, you know, we've been in and out of this talk of the conversation through different episodes with different people, and I totally get your end of it. Also, you being in the woods on those days, you know, Sunday's a peaceful day for you that you don't have to worry about if you're out on public ground on a creek somewhere or a river. You know, I get that. I get that end of it, too, that you just like that day to take a breather. And then I know there's a more, you know, it's not just the hunter's woods.
Well, I'm with him in some ways, but in archery season, in most cases, it's not like it really matters, right?
No.
But in rifle season, I totally understand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
because it's dangerous out there.
I will say one thing. Being a fly fisherman, we are vain. If I have to wear orange over my nice camo jacket or wear an orange hat instead of my nice Yeti flat brim, it's going to make the pictures look goofy.
Hey, you're not the only one. And I'm pretty vain. I'm vain in my own hunting attire, too. So, I get you. So, okay, Chad, let's take a step back. Now that we got that out of the way, Chad, let everybody know what you do. I mean, you got your own podcast, right?
Yeah, we do. It's the Shenango Valley Shenanigans. If you want to look it up, it's SVS Fishing. So,
where can everybody find you at, or is it just Google?
If you go on iTunes, search SVS Fishing. If you go on podbean.com, it's SVS Fishing. On Facebook and Instagram, Facebook, it's still Shenango Valley Shenanigans. On Instagram, it's SVS Fishing. We're a group of four guys that we love fly fishing in general, but we all started gear fishing at the beginning, like everyone else. And we've just slowly evolved, and every week we interview some of the best, well-known people in fly fishing industry. Just as an example, this week we had on Dan Frazier, who is a genius carp fisherman from South Dakota. We had him on the phone for 2 hours, and he just told us everything you ever wanted to know about carp fishing with a fly rod.
So, what made you guys switch over to fly fishing?
I can tell you the exact day when I started fly fishing, like, solely, if you want to hear it.
Sure, let's. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I had just gotten married, so it was 10 years ago, and I went below the Shenango Dam, and I was throwing a spinning rod with a trout magnet for trout. And I saw these carp tailing. I was like, what in the hell is that? What are they doing back there? So I went back into the shallows, and I caught two carp on a trout magnet. I was like, God damn, I could do this with a fly rod. So the next day, I came back with two weighted woolly buggers with a hot orange cone head so I could see them. And I think I landed six carp that day. And I said, man, I'm never going back to a spinning rod. This is way more fun. So the lowly old carp is what transformed me.
I would not call a carp lowly, man. When you hook those suckers, they run. And people call them the freshwater bonefish, right?
Yeah. I know you guys are fly fishermen. Have you ever targeted carp? Do you ever sight fish for them?
I have, personally, yeah.
That is the most fun you can have with your clothes on.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what.
It is fun. It is. I hooked a couple carp one time on a four-weight, which was did not work out well for me. But I've targeted them a couple times. And I want to get into that. But let's continue on your journey as a fly fisherman. How did that evolve to muskies and spalies and pike and all of that?
Okay. Well, like I stated, we live in Western Pennsylvania, where the only trout streams are fully stocked by the Pennsylvania Game Commission. I made the conscious effort that if I want to chase a fish, I want to be born and bred in that waterway. So I was like, God, there's no trout around here. What's the next best thing? Smallmouth, duh. they're like the fat girl at the bar. Anyone can take one home. I love them. They'll hit poppers. Yeah. They hit poppers. They hit streamers just under the surface, which I think is more exciting because you get more hits than you would with a popper. They hit jig flies, which you could bring that from your gear background and chase smallmouth with like a jig fly. Those Sculpin helmets from the Flyman Company are great for that. And then we caught smallmouth and just, you know, everywhere we were going, we were catching smallmouth and catching a lot of them. And I'm like, man, this is cool, but what's the next thing? You know, it's like Motley Crue. They started out smoking dope, and then they went to cocaine, then, you know, just progressed. We want something better, bigger, better, faster, stronger. So we, doing this podcast, we talked to Brad Bowen. Like, oh, how's he do that? We watched a Zero to Hero video. We're like, man, that's cool. There's muskie around here. Let's do this. So we all started. We had 8-weight rods, and we just tied giant clousers out of weave hair we got from the ghetto. And I was like, oh. you think I'm joking. I walk in there.
No, I...
I,
funny,
I walk into the, I have a weave store, and the guy's like, oh, what's up, man? And then he tells all the ladies around me, like, this is the most, he buys the most kinky fiber. He's the best. I'm like, yeah, man. That's how I want to be known. So,
we start. So you moved into muskies. What was it like the first time you caught a musk?
Oh, my God. It was, did you ever hear Van Halen's Eruption?
That, no, I don't think.
Oh, you got to check it out. Van Halen has a song, Eruption. It's just a guitar solo, but it sounds like a earth or like a volcano erupting. It's awesome. So that's kind of what it felt like. It was just amazing. I can tell you where I was, but I'm not going to. I was standing.
I know that too. I understand. We have spots that have muskies around here too, so, and we try not to let that out of the bag.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a secret spot. A lot of people go there, but I'm still not going to broadcast that. But I was standing on the bank of the river, and I was stripping my fly in. It was, I can remember, it was like 8 inches under the surface of the water, so I could see it coming in. And then just out of nowhere, a mid-30s fish comes up. I see him eat my fly and turn around. It was like he robbed a bank. He just ate and got the heck out of Dodge. And, man, I can still remember it, and I was like, I was with my buddy named Justin. I was like, Justin, bring the net. And we just high-fived and slapped hands and hooted and hollered. I don't think I made a cast the rest of the day.
Right. That had to be really cool.
Yeah, it was. It was the common.
How do you do it when once you get it in? Those are some nasty teeth, right?
They are. But if you, have you guys ever been in contact with muskies at all?
No.
Okay.
I've caught a few. That's it for me. They're about the same deal, though.
They're similar. I know trout, you get crucified if you go anywhere near the gills. With muskie, yeah, you got to slip your fingers up under the gill and, like, right where the jaw is. There's a perfect handle. So you have your two fingers inside the gill plate and your thumb on the outside, on the flap of skin, and it's just a perfect handhold where you're nowhere near the gill rakers, you're not going to hurt the fish, but you have total control of the fish if you hold it right there and just pinch. I like to hold the head in my left hand and that's what I do. Head in the left hand and then like mid belly section with my right, and then you have total control of that fish, and you always want to keep it horizontal because the vertical hold is really hard on those fish. It stretches their spine. And it's just not good for them.
Right.
So another thing, you always want to have pliers, and good wire cutters. Because if say something was to happen and the fish took the fly down deep, you want to be able to get it out, cut the fly, That way you get the whole fly out of its mouth, and you're not leaving that in the fish to hinder them from continuing to feed, you know?
Oh, yeah.
The gear guys cut treble hooks all the time. Just, it makes it a lot faster.
We were talking with, remember when we had Bill Anderson on here, and he was talking about having the trackers?
Yes.
Yeah, and they'll let those things just pass right through the fish.
Yeah.
Yep. And they'll pass it, no problem. So, I hear what you're saying there. That shouldn't hurt the fish, right?
No. But like I said, as long as you get like the mass of the fly out, like where all the fur and feathers are, if you get that out, and like I said, so it doesn't hinder them from continuing to feed once you release them. Because these are the fish of 10,000 casts. So you don't want to hurt you. It's hard to explain how much care we take of these fish. Because we love to chase them, and there's not many of them.
Yeah, what is, like, let's say a solid, like, the best musky river that you fish in your area? How many per mile?
Oh, you're gonna put me on the spot there. I don't know the answer to that question. I do know there is an outflow.
Yeah.
That we fish quite frequently, and they say directly under that outflow, there's like a pool, and they say there's probably 50 to 70 fish right there.
Really? But, and they just don't attack. They're not as aggressive as...
Well, just to give everybody an idea, just give us your success rate. Just say over a one season
or
period.
How long have you been fishing for muskie?
Okay, let's do this. My first 2 years, I had one follow. So connected with zero fish.
Dude, you have a lot more pay. See, this is why I'll never be a muskie fisherman.
Oh, believe me, throw musky flies, I caught some hog smallmouth.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I was fishing in a river that the concentration of musky was really low, but the concentration of smallmouth was really high. So anything over a smallmouth over 18, 19 inches is not afraid of an 8 or 9 inch fly.
Right. That's true. That make you know that brings up a good point. So you're not completely getting skunked on the whole deal.
Yeah, because they're eating suckers of fish all the time. Right?
Yes, exactly. So, but my first 2 years, I had one follow. My third year, I landed four. Last year, I landed two, and they were both in the same day. And then
you've caught.
And then this year, I landed one in January so far this year.
So you've caught six fish in 6 years?
Yeah, something like that. But a lot of time has been spent.
Wow. Yeah, hey, man, I got to give you credit because that kind of puts me to the point where I'm probably not going to...
Oh, look, the passion is there money. With these guys, just like it is with, you know, you or I chasing a hatch, though. I really think it's cool as hell.
I do, too.
These guys are doing.
I do, too, man. I think it's awesome. I just don't know that I can put that time in and not have...
You could not. I know you well enough that you... There's no way.
I need to have some success.
I know, and it has to happen pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
That's just the way you are, dude. I'm not knocking it, but you could not.
No, I'm being honest. I don't envy those guys, but I admire them for their passion and their patience.
I'll tell you one thing. Another motivating factor is one of the co-hosts from RSVS podcast, he just bought Urban Fly Co. So he is now a commercial tire of musky flies. So we do a lot of musky fly fishing. I take a lot of pictures for him. So it's like constant promotion and it just trying to help get the name out.
Is that why you guys were dying those bucktails?
Yeah, that's one thing. we actually just sold about 40 of them last week.
Yeah.
So
nice.
We
did a supplemental income right there. Cause how much do those flies go?
Mark is selling. All right, musky flies are goofy because you get singles and doubles, and they have all kind of different goofy names. He ties mainly Bufords. And a single Buford, I think he sells for $18. And a double, I think he sells for $25 or $27. I could be wrong.
I want to lose. Holy cow.
Yeah.
So,
but they're not quick jobbers to tie.
Right.
If you've ever seen do you ever see the full dress Atlantic salmon flies?
Nope.
Like with the married wings and. Like
oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, these musky flies look nothing like that. but the same amount of work goes in, I would say. Cuz you're reverse tying bucktail and you're getting we have a local chicken farmer actually that we get our hackle from, and it's all a labor of love. And I'm still using weave hair.
Are you really?
Yeah, yeah. I started making weave hair into brushes, like pipe cleaners, and tying monster game changers. Are you guys familiar with the game changer fly?
No. What? Fill us in. We're out of the loop when it comes to this.
Oh, you guys are totally out of the loop. You got to look up Blaine Chocolate, first off. he created the game changer, but it's a massive, like, the big ones like Itai are going to be 8 shanks and 2 hooks. And then you wrap these pipe cleaners basically on each shank, and they progressively get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you trim them and taper them like a cigar, so they look like a fish. And then they swim because they have all these different, they have 8 different joints in them, so they swim like crazy.
They're all like a huge articulating fly with like 8 joints in it.
Yeah, yeah, it looks just like the spine of a fish while it's swimming.
And how long is this fly?
Oh, those ones I'll tie probably 8 to 9 inches because they
Holy
do feel like
shit.
they feel like a wet sock. When you're trying to cast them,
I'll bet.
And that's where the rod. That's where the rods come in, and the lines.
Well,
the fly lines are. What was that?
What size fishing?
Rods. I have a 12 weight and a 10 weight. And okay. The 12 weight is strictly like a lake rod. I use it when we go fish lakes. I have a 450 grain full sink line on it, and it's for big flies. As big as I can throw on a lake, I'm going to throw. We have a couple natural lakes around here. And we go and fish those, and just as big and beefy a fly as I can throw. And that's it. Find weed edges, find points. And they're normally sitting there.
How far out there can you cast?
Oh.
An 8 to 9 inch Blaine chocolate. Nasty blood.
Wet sock.
Yeah, wet.
On a good day, like if I hadn't been out drinking hard the night before, which barely right. ever happens, I can cast, let's say you have a full line and have about 4 wraps still on the reel.
What?
Yeah.
So how many feet?
95
yards.
95 feet.
You can cast 95 feet with that thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
not the, there's a super technique. If you look it up online, it's called a Belgian cast where you kind of roll your line in a circle. So you never have a slack line. It's not going straight over your back and straight forward. So you're kind of rolling it and double hauling at the end. And it takes away a lot of the impact off your elbow and your shoulder and your wrist because you're not getting the loose to tight snapping jerking. So it makes it a lot easier. And if you keep your arms compact, I like keeping my casting arm compact into the side of my body and definitely exaggerating with my offhand, which is my left hand. With the double haul, start at your eyebrow and pull down to your hip. I don't know if you heard my voice shaking because I'm doing this as I'm talking.
Yeah, I get it though. That I see what you're saying. That's a huge double haul.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, wham.
And like I said,
I just did.
If you're on a lake and you're in a boat, there's nothing that you have to worry about with your back cast. And if it's a windy day. Put your back to the wind and launch that sucker up in the air and let it get into the jet stream.
Yeah.
You know?
True.
So that technique then is to lay that 95 feet of line out and then basically just strip that baby the whole way to the...
Yes. And your presentation varies. A lot of times I like to tuck my rod up under my right armpit and then strip with both my right and left hand. Boom, 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 boom. And then pause, and boom, boom, boom. And then once I get about 30 feet to the boat, I'll switch it to put the rod back into my hand and then do a single hand strip, boom, 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 boom. And then that way when I come into the figure eight, I'm not pausing to bring the rod into my hand and then start to figure eight. Because if you do have a fish following and you pause for a second, that fish is going to turn off and go away.
Well, I have a question on, I mean, obviously then you're stripping into a basket, correct?
No, we're in boats and we try to keep the floor as snag free as possible.
Okay. So you don't use a basket.
No, it would probably be wise if to do that, but you know, we stay out drinking the night before, so we forget the baskets.
My next question is, what happens if you have a hookup when you're double stripping like that?
Okay.
And that rod in your arm.
That's perfect, because if you have the rod in your hand or in your arm, Pitt, either way, you want to do what's called a strip set. So with your left hand, you pull the line as hard as you can and keep the rod tip pointed at the fish. Because let's say you're out in your driveway.
Can I stop you for a second, Chad?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got this mental picture in my head, right?
Okay.
And you feel the fish connect.
Oh, right? Yes.
Are you immediately pulling and strip setting, or are you letting it take it a little bit?
No, you don't let them take it. Let me go back to another story. I have caught 6 muskies, I think. The longest fight I've had has maybe been 45 seconds.
Oh, they don't fight hard.
They don't fight hard, but we're using the core of our fly line, I think, is 65-pound test. I use a 2-foot section of 60-pound mono and then a 1-foot section of 40-pound bite guard, the wire.
Right. So which is wire?
It's knotable wire. I like the Rio brand, but whatever. Whatever you can get. A lot of guys use bead lawn from the craft stores. It's all the same. But, yeah, like I said, caring for the fish. The quicker you get that fish in the basket, the quicker you can release it and have it swim away safely.
So as soon as you feel the fish, you're strip setting.
Strip set and lay the wood to it, man. That's
right.
Number one key. Lay the wood to that fish. I've never had a muskie on a reel.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I get that. I can see it. All right, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, you're fine. But, okay, back to the strip set. Are you guys familiar with the strip set in comparison to the trout set?
Yeah, well, you can strip set with trout, too.
Yeah, I mean, the trout set is when you raise your rod tip up, like you were dry fly fishing, so I've been told.
But it'd be almost down and pull.
Yeah.
Right?
But the strip set is you point your rod at the fish and you pull your left hand or your stripping hand and set the hook that way.
Right.
I like to incorporate both.
Fishing a woolly bugger, you know, or a streamer, when you do that set, you're obviously not raising the rod tip up. You're pulling straight, you know, right?
Well, I've done it on times where I've had my slack line in my left hand had just been like, you're not expecting a hit, but you're kind of like messing around with your slack there.
When are you not expecting a hit? I'm always expecting a hit.
hit a fly sometimes after it starts drifting.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
So you've got this slack line out here away from your rod hand, and you get this unexpected hit. You have to set it. You have to strip set it.
Okay.
Because you can't pull, you know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah. And like I said, I'll incorporate the strip set, and then I'll sweep the rod to my side just to try to catch up as fast as possible. I do that with smallmouth and carp also, you know. My friends always say, you're trout setting. But no, it's not a trout set. It's a strip set and a sweep. So that's how I like to roll. Because I find it catches the line up faster too.
Yeah, which you need with smallies because they take it so quick.
So, can you guys fill me in on your smallmouth game? What do you guys do out there? What do you like? Do you fish for smallmouth at all?
Yeah. So what we'll do? Yeah. I'm gonna say it. The West Branch of Susquehanna is a great smallmouth fishery. It is. I'm throwing it out there. There's plenty of river out there.
It's not a secret.
Right. It's a fantastic smallmouth fishery. The best fishing, I think, is in the dead of the summer.
With a little bit lower water flow.
Yeah.
And we're taking most of our stuff off the top with poppers.
Yeah. Are you guys fishing from shore? You getting in boats at all? How do you guys approach it?
Well, that time of year we're wading a lot.
Yeah. It's hard, man. I don't know how you guys do smallmouth fishing from boats, from like a canoe or something like kayak. Or I tried that last year. I'm this close to going to a spin rod next summer because man, that's tough. I mean, I do it, and you can catch fish, but when you watch your buddy next to you and he's got a spin rod and he's just crushing it.
Well, I think what he's asking, we're not boat fishing per se because the water levels drop so far that we can do it out of a kayak or a canoe. We can't do it off of a flat bottom or a John boat or anything like
that. Well, even that, where we fish, if the water gets to the point where the fishing's really, really good, like bumper fishing's really good, you need to be wading it because you can't boat more than 200 yards without getting out and dragging your boat.
Yeah, that's what I mean, the water levels are usually pretty.
Yeah.
I'll tell you guys what, another one of the co-hosts from our show just bought a Smith fly raft. We take that thing all summer down to Shenango and just pound smallmouth. And it drafts in about 2 inches of water with three guys, and I'm a fatty.
No way.
Yeah.
2 inches of water.
Yeah, man.
Three guys,
and I'm a tubby.
That would be weird. Oh, yeah.
And I have a drift boat, and we'll take that when it gets the water levels are higher. But the Smith fly is definitely easier. It's a lighter boat. It has handles, so you can put in it non-traditional boat launches. So, like, if you know a farmer with a field next to a river, you can put in right there. It is nice. It's the best fishing tool that we have come across yet.
I've heard that, too. I have friends who have inflatables, and they've said the same thing. It's way better for low water condition.
Your boy Pat has an NRS raft. It's a little bit bigger than the one my buddy has, but it's still a nice vessel.
NRS goes back to my days of whitewater boating.
That's exactly it. That's the same brand, and Pat's is probably a whitewater raft with a rowing frame on it.
Right, yeah. So how do you approach smallmouth?
9 times out of 10, we're in either my drift boat or a raft, and
yep.
We take one rod apiece. We always set it up so we have three guys in the boat. The guy in the middle, it's his job to keep the mood in the boat light. His job is to crack jokes, make fun of people, and crack beers for everyone else fishing. That's how we roll. So, I will say our number one producing fly last year, Murdich minnow, bar none. It's super easy. I can't tie them to save my life, but they swim and they catch smallmouth.
Murdich minnow.
Yeah. It's just
where can our listeners find that pattern at?
Google.
Murdich?
Yeah, Murdich minnow. I will say this. Great Lakes fly, Eli Brandt, he ties them. He ties a great Murdich minnow, and they're for sale. So
cool.
I'll throw a plug out for him.
There you go.
Like I said, another one of our prior show guests. So,
yep.
Yeah, Murdich minnow dominated last year. We caught a lot of fish on that. Clousers, they dominate. I don't care how fancy you want to get or how whatever. You can do packed deer hair all you want, poppers style, you know. Clouser minnow is going to outfish it. But if you want to see the strike, which I like to do. That's why I smallmouth fish. I like to see the strike. I like throwing flies like Tommy Lynch's Drunk and Disorderly. Have you guys seen that?
No.
Okay. It's an articulated fly. It's not very big. Maybe 3-4 inches. And they're not weighted. And the front hook is a jig style hook. Like a 26 degree bend on the end of it. And you pack deer hair real tight. And then you cut it at a wedge, so it's kind of like a Rapala lip.
Yep.
And you just strip little strips, boom, 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 and that fly just darts and swims.
As you're stripping, it dives a little bit.
It dives and swims. Yeah. Kind of like a floating Rapala would.
Yep.
That's why Tommy designed it. He said he was sick and tired of the Rapala fishermen beating him on the Pierre Marquette with brown trout. So he designed that, the Drunken Disorderly.
That's cool.
That's cool. But that's another killer. Nine times out of 10, I'm fishing with a sinking line or an intermediate line. Even if I'm fishing topwater poppers. Because I'm smallmouth fishing, I'm not making 90 feet casts. That would that would get old. You know, 35, 40 feet casts. And, you know, the fish are mainly sitting, if they're going to eat a popper, they're going to mainly be sitting close to the bank. So pop, 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 pop. And then you're out of your strike zone. So the intermediate line isn't going to affect a topwater popper at all. In fact, it might pull it down a little bit and give it a shimmy under the water before it floats back to the surface, which I find helps a little bit. Whereas if you're throwing a popper with a floating line, if it's like a fresh popper that's dry, I find they skitter across the top a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like that. I like when it kind of pulls it down and then has to float back up.
We've had luck with anything that when you're doing that first bang, 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 it's pushing a lot of water. Anything that makes a lot of noise, anything that pushes a lot of water seems to do well.
And I will say this. I had a buddy from Maine come in this summer to fish smallmouth with us. And he taught me a new tactic, which that's another thing. Always pay attention to someone in your boat that's new to you because they have different tactics that work for them. And this thing actually works. He casts a popper out and then just lets it sit, you know, 30, 35 seconds, just letting it set. And then boom, smallmouth comes and hits it. It's the weirdest thing in the world. It doesn't fit or it doesn't work for my style of fishing. Cause if you can tell I'm talking fast, that's how I like to fish. That's how I like to go. I like to roll, but it worked and it surprised the crap out of me.
Yeah. So,
listen, I got another question before you go. Because you're talking about you guys being in the boat and stuff. I have you pegged as a, when you're doing this smallmouth fishing, there's got to be a little bit of competition between you guys. You all throw in and into the pot, and the guy with the most wins, or how's that go?
No, honestly, we don't count anymore.
No,
but there's a technique we learned that at the end of the day, if you want to find out how many fish you have, you can actually do it. We name each fish.
So, okay.
So the first fish is Alex, the second fish is Betty, then Charles.
Oh.
So you go in alphabetic order.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And normally you stay the same sex. So A, B, C, D, E is all males. And then if you do happen to catch more than 26, you start over again with female.
Yeah, there you go. that's funny you bring that up, Steve, because the other day I was fishing with Dave, and he said, how many fish you catch? Like 8, 10? I was like, I don't really know. Once it gets past 4, I kind of lose track. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm happy. Once I'm content, I lose track. But I could see that, though. Like, if you do want to know how many fish you're catching.
It would be always. That's a good point. I mean, it's always probably easy to remember the last name of the fish you caught.
I just typically remember that I outfish you.
That's all that matters at the end.
No. Honest to God, last time Steve and I fished together, he outfished me.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, the Cleveland Browns won a football game, dude.
Whoa. I'm close enough to the Ohio line over here, boys.
Oakland Raiders won.
So I will say, if someone catches a 20, we do stop at our gangs and they all get around, or they get around on everyone else in the boat.
That's a good idea.
That's cool.
I like that.
Yeah, I like
that
too.
Because our gangs is known for the best wings in town around Sharon and Dollar High Life Lights.
So beat that.
20. Does that happen often?
I think it happened. No, last year we had two that were 19 and a half.
Oh, okay.
We had one on, we were musky fishing on a lake. That one ended up being 18 and three quarter, I think. So no, we haven't broken 20 last year. Or we hadn't broken 20 last year.
Don't come here. There are no 20 inch fish here.
Oh,
There are no 20 inch fish here. Actually, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we interviewed a guest that was out in you guys' area that's a smallmouth guide strictly. So we know there's some big fish.
There's no secrets anymore. No, you're right. There are definitely 20 inch fish here without question. And, you know, the guys who throw bait on, they kill it. The one guy. What do you call him? Some kind of catfish. He catches these little tiny catfish, and he'll throw them on the hook. He catches huge fish.
Really?
I'll have to ask him what they are. But and I bet that pattern would do well. But little tiny. I don't know what he calls them, black cats or something like that. I don't know. But he crushes it with them.
Yeah.
Like, he said he would catch 20-some inch fish all the time.
Holy smokes.
Now, whether he's telling the truth or not, you know, this is the same guy that told me he caught an owl out of the air driving down the road.
Well, then he's absolutely lying. Yeah. I was up a year ago, dude.
No, he's a good fisherman. He's a good hunter. So I trust him some. So
you believe his stories, not his numbers, right?
That's right. Yep. Well, yeah, a little bit of some of both. I believe if he throws pictures in, then I believe him. You're right there by Lake Erie, right?
We are.
You're not doing any steelhead fishing. You're not doing any smallmouth fishing out of Lake Erie.
I have not went steelhead fishing in probably 4 years, I'm going to say. Final
what
guess.
About smallmouth fishing out of Lake Erie? Because there are some monsters in there.
I will say my buddy has a raft and I have a drift boat with no motor. So Lake Erie is kind of out of the question.
It's scary.
I know there are a couple of... like Conneaut Harbor and stuff like that, that we could go. And our other buddy, when we go Lake Muskie fishing, he has a 14-foot boat with a 15 horse. So we could, that's doable, but I don't know. It's still a little iffy.
Yeah. So,
and don't get me wrong, steelhead's fun. I used to love steelhead fishing. I just can't justify driving. What is it? It's an hour and 10 minutes for me to get to Erie to fight people when I could go out my back door and fish for smallmouth or fish for largemouth bass or muskie or pike and not see a soul.
Yeah, I hear that.
You know, that fishing's my time, and I like to keep it that way.
If you're picking one of the warm water species, what would it be and why?
Oh, you can't do that to me. What month is it?
Yeah, right. How about it?
Because that's generally how we go. We musky fish until they start to spawn. We leave them be. Once they start to spawn, we go to smallmouth. When the smallmouth...
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I want to interrupt. So here's the thing. And this is what I've noticed the difference is between hunters and fishermen. Hunters don't give a shit whether the species is spawning or not, right?
Yeah, 100%.
They use that to their advantage.
Oh, yeah, that's a rut, man. We're going to go shoot a big one while he's trying to get laid.
That's right. And fishermen, like, they're just like, nah, let that guy get a piece, you know?
Yeah.
I don't understand the difference there. Like, there's a fish out there. It's not like there's not more fish than there are bucks, right?
Nah, you're right. But like I said, it goes back to caring for the fish. with muskie in Western Pennsylvania, we don't have a lot of natural reproduction, honest to God. And if we give these fish a chance to do it, and it could happen by a slim chance, I'm 100% going to let that fish, you know, fornicate and make more baby muskie wild.
Right.
Smallmouth, if they're on beds and you pull that fish off a bed, that's a chance for a predator to come in and eat eggs. And that's less smallmouth that we get to enjoy, you know? Carp, when they're spawning, I will catch them. I don't care. But like I said, it's the wild fish that we love, and we try to protect them.
So I thought, aren't the majority of muskies sterile?
The tigers are sterile.
That's it. My bad. Yeah. It's just like tiger trout, right?
Yes. The they're hybrids.
Yeah.
Kind of like, okay. Do you guys have hybrid bass around there? The wipers, we like to call them?
No, I don't think so. Do we?
Not that I know of.
Oh, no. Oh boys.
Wiper.
It's a hybrid white bass. It's a white bass mixed with a striped bass. So they get about 15 pounds is huge. And we have them in two reservoirs around here and one river system. And oh my God, they are a hoot. They come up and crush flies next to the surface. You can skate a fly on top like the steelhead guys do. But do that with like a weighted, unweighted streamer and just skate it across the top, and they'll just come out of the water and smash it. That's a secret love of mine.
So are they more aggressive because of their hybridization, just like the tiger trout are?
They put them in a lot of lakes that have like a shad problem. Like if there's too many shad in a lake, they put these in to control the shad. They're just feeding machines. All they do is feed and chase the shad balls around. They're like the stripers in Raystown Lake, but not as big. They don't get as big, and they don't breed, so they have to continually be stocked in because they're hybrids. They're like a donkey. Donkeys can't breed.
Right.
Did we get an answer
for what?
What his favorite is?
You guys are holding my feet to the fire.
We can hear it.
Carp. 100%.
All right.
Final answer.
Give us your top three carp tips. Because I think carp are, I don't think they get the credit they deserve.
They definitely do not get the credit they deserve. Number one tip, find out where the bow fishermen are going and go somewhere else. The bow fishermen will ruin a carp spot. They will put added pressure to a carp spot that if you find one and then the word gets out and the bow fishermen come in, that's no longer going to be a great carp fishing or fly fishing area.
So that's a big thing. You live is bow fishing, because we don't see that really at all, do we?
It's not a big thing, but it's a thing.
That's the thing in here. It's not huge either, but I know guys that are doing it. I know guys that are doing it out of John Bush in some of the deeper holes on the river.
Yeah.
We have some big.
I have a buddy that does it, and he'll fill up trash cans full of fish. And then I'm like, what are you doing with these fish?
Does he eat them?
No.
Because I've heard carp is actually pretty good eating.
Actually, let me give one more plug for our podcast. This week's guest, Dan Frazier, actually gives a delicious recipe for carp.
Nice.
So.
Nice.
My buddy fills up garbage cans full of them, and then I'm like, what do you do? And he said, well, we fertilizer, or throw them on a dead-end road. Like that's wanton waste. I can't see it.
I agree with you 100%. If you're going to kill something, I think you eat it. As a matter of fact, on this podcast, we ate a coyote one time.
I heard that. And was it? Steve said he would never eat it again?
Yeah, I don't know that I would.
I would eat it again.
Going back to that, the filling the garbage can, why do they go through all the effort of dragging that thing around and disposing of it? If you're going to kill it and waste it, why not just throw it back in the water?
Because there's other boats on the water, and they'll see you just shoot and release fish, and that's not allowed, I don't think.
I get it.
So you gotta put on the good face. Like
yeah,
I said,
put a so you get off the water and then. I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
I think it'd be really fun to bow fish them, but
I do. But I would keep.
We would eat them.
Yeah, sure. I would be excited about.
And we cook them, and if we didn't like them, I probably wouldn't bow hunt them anymore.
That's right.
You know what I mean. Yeah.
You know what? Let's get into another cooking topic. This week was the Mentored Youth Trout Day. It was last Saturday.
Yeah.
So my buddy, Jay, that is on the podcast with me, he took my son out trout fishing and his daughter. They're 6 days apart age-wise. And I had to work on Saturday. So Jay took my son out with him.
That's really cool, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, it was great. I was getting pictures at work of my son holding trout. Jay taught him how to use a spinning rod. I can never teach him how to use a spinning rod, but it takes someone who's not dad to show him how to do it, I guess.
Yeah. And, sometimes it does, man. Yep.
But by the time I got off work, they had, been gone and went to the pump track and shit. And, we said, "Hey, Nolan, you want to go catch more trout?" He said, "Yeah, Dad." So we went and we caught some more trout, and he cast the spinning rod all by himself. He's reeling in, and a trout smashed a spinner. I was like, "Oh my God, this is the coolest thing!" So, I was super pumped, and it was probably one of my favorite fishing days I've had in the last 5 years. And we were catching stupid stock trout. But
how old is he?
He's five.
So he's. He'll remember that day probably for the rest of his life, because it's just the point of where you start remembering things. And those, I remember going fishing whenever I was.
I'll tell you who else is going to remember that the rest of their life's dad.
Yep.
Oh, 100%. Like I said, I was getting pictures, and my mother-in-law was there, and she was taking videos. I was getting foggy-eyed at work, just seeing my boy catching trout all on his own, and my buddy just being the great guy, helping him out. So
that's cool.
It was a cool day, but we ended up, we caught two, and he said, "Dad, I want to keep them. I want to eat them." And then, you know, after he had caught like 20 fish in the morning, and then we went back, the dads were allowed to fish with Youth Mentored Fishing Day. I caught a 22 inch trout.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
On a trout magnet. but it got deep hooked and was bleeding, so I couldn't release it. You know, it's one of those things. Yep. Can't release it. We made a trout dip that was so good out of that fish. All it was
let's hear it.
I grilled it. Like I wrapped it in tinfoil, grilled it, and then I flaked all the meat off the rib cage.
Yep.
And then I put it in a, like, so it was chopped up trout meat, and I put mayonnaise. I chopped up dill pickles, and I chopped up banana peppers and mixed them all with it. And it is so good. It's like tuna fish salad. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm making my mouth water just thinking about it, because, you know, a lot of times where we fish, everything is, it's all wild trout streams. It's all catch. There are a lot of times where I want to keep a couple trout in, like, throw them on the grill, just like that. Wrap them in some tinfoil.
Don't taste bad at all, man. I've made plenty of them over the years. They're good.
I'm with you on that. Like, wrap them in tinfoil.
Yeah.
Throw some butter in there with it. Maybe some garlic. Right?
They taste best on the water when you're fishing with a couple beers after you're done.
That's what I'm talking about.
Heck yeah, man.
Little fire, a little bit of charcoal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's.
Oh. We need to do that once this year, at least once.
That dip sounds really good.
It does.
It was really good.
Like tortilla chips in it, or what?
I'll tell you what, I made a breakfast sandwich. I chopped an English bagel in half, I toasted it. I fried an egg, popped the yolk so it was all hard, like an egg McMuffin. Put that on, some cheese, and then I put that trout dip on top of that. Made like a trout McMuffin. It was really good.
That's awesome. That's
yeah.
So now that you've sidetracked, I have to go. Like, I have to talk about this, and we're going to come back to your second tip. But
okay,
I need to talk. This week, I made venison scotch eggs for my family. Do you know what a scotch egg is?
Yeah.
I don't. Can you explain it?
Okay. So this is what you do. You soft boil an egg, right?
Mm-hmm.
That way the center's still runny, okay? And then you take the meat, you lay it out, you peel the egg.
Typically a sausage.
Right. You wrap the egg in the meat. And then you know, with some spices and, you know, whatnot, you dip it in flour, dip it in coarse breadcrumbs, dip it in fine breadcrumbs. Oh, wait. Dip it in flour, dip it in egg, dip it in coarse breadcrumbs, dip it in fine breadcrumbs, and then you're frying it in peanut oil at about 350 degrees. It, when you cut that for about 9 minutes, okay, when you cut that, the egg is still runny, and you've got this beautiful mess. I mean, It's fantastic.
Oh, I was. You remember I told you guys I was the fatty on the boat? Yeah. Yeah, you guys are adding to my problem.
You should do it just with, make some, do it with Hamburg, or if you can get venison off your buddies or whatever, and mix some Hamburg in there, and then do that. I even threw cooked a little bit of bacon and mixed it in there, you know, because what's not better with bacon? So, and then I served that with rice. And if you mix, you know, the egg yolk and the meat and everything with the rice and you, as one bite, bam!
Oh, boom.
It's money. All right. Sorry. Tip number two for carp.
Get good polarized glasses. That's the key. You have to be able to see the mouth of the fish.
And what is your brand of polarized glasses?
My brand is prescription Ray-Ban, because that's what my prescription doctor had.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't wear
regular sunglasses because I'm not only am I fat, I'm bald and blind. So I got all the good traits.
So I got you there. But
yeah. Like I said, I have Ray-Bans. All my friends rock Costa because they end up winning them at raffles or got them cheap off someone. So they all rock Costas.
And do they notice a difference between the Costas, or I think the Costa people actually call them Costas, right?
They might. Yeah, it was Costa Del Mar originally, I think.
Yeah, and I call them Costas, too. I do the same thing. But do they notice a difference between those and, like, say, your Ray-Bans?
Well, they can't put my Ray-Bans on because that'd be looking through telescopes.
Yeah, that's true.
one of the guys have glass Costas, and the other guy has the polycarbonate, and the glass, they say, is way better. It's a little bit heavier. But the glass, it performs better.
It's night and day. I can tell you, and they don't scratch. The glass ones, unless you really, I've had mine for a year, and I am hard on my stuff, and they haven't scratched it.
When I just recently bought a pair of them, but I bought them off of, I don't know if anybody that you know, or you guys use that Steep and Cheap site that has the outdoor gear and stuff. I bought a pair off of their glass, but they were like 2 years ago's model. So I got them for like $79, which is crazy.
The cost.
But I distinctly, as soon as I put them on and got on the water, noticed the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Between the, I always wore, like, I always had the cheaper ones because I'm hard like he is, like losing them, breaking them, scratching them. But these
the difference is, though, when you pay that kind of money for them, you're like, where are my glasses at? Where are they?
Well,
you know, because you're worried about that kind of thing.
Like I said, I'm getting leftover models from a couple of years ago, which I think I've had yours on too. What it did is, though, is it spoiled me. I'll never own another pair of sunglasses to fish with. I know that.
It sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right. So you want to see the fish's mouth. You want to see him take it.
Yeah.
Are you watching gills to expend a little bit of, like, dirt?
No, I can't see that well. But if you can see the mouth is... It's a brighter orange, and if it comes towards your fly, and, you know, you see it do anything, hook sets are free. Give it a yank, yeah. You know? That's what I always say.
I tell people that all the time. You know what I say is, like, don't be afraid to look stupid because you're sitting on air or
right.
Water.
I'm with you, Chad, too. I can't see that well either.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Like, if that thing's coming and I see its mouth or, like, I see it get close... But sometimes way too soon, and you're like, God damn it! Like, you know, you just hit it just a wee little bit quick. But
the ones that'll bum rush your fly, they're the ones that get me because you strip, 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 and then you see them bum rushing your fly, and it's like, oh, and then it's gone because you pulled the fly out of its face. Like, I do that more often than not.
And aside from your tips. What are you fishing? Just woolly buggers for those?
Oh, not anymore. Woolly buggers will catch the majority of the fish that you throw your fly at. I'm trying to represent the same thing because when I was tying woolly buggers, I would tie olive body, brown marabou tail, crayfish.
Yep.
So now I just get fancier. Tie crayfish with squirrel tail claws. Crayfish with rabbit strip claws. I like that Swiss straw material. I wrap it. All the flies I tie, I want to be riding hook point up. So you tie the lead dumbbell eye on the top of the hook shank like you would a Clouser minnow. And I put the Swiss straw on. It would be the inside of the hook, which would actually be the top. And what I pull the Swiss straw up. And then I wrap it with copper wire to give it like a segmented look.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of times with the body, like before I pull the Swiss straw up, I'll make a... Are you guys familiar with dubbing loops?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I use Craft Store craft fur. I pull all the under fur out of it and put it into a dubbing loop and spin the crap out of it and just make that the whole body. I pull that Swiss straw up and then I segment it with the copper wire, and that's basically a carp fly.
Cool. Cool.
Like I said, our guest last week on the podcast, he's throwing size eights and sixes. I'm throwing size ones, twos, and fours. So different parts of the country take different size flies to catch these carp. Luckily where we are, I can get away with throwing a bigger fly because, our carp aren't as pressured and they're keyed in on eating crayfish.
Ours are like that too. Ours don't get pressured very hard except for with corn.
Okay. I have a dirty little secret. We have a restaurant here, that feeds the carp bread. They'll throw dough balls or not dough balls, but they'll throw hot dog buns. And stuff over the side of the bank, and the carp are there. So we'll go underneath the bridge right behind this restaurant, and I made this. It's a bread fly. It's spun deer hair, and I pulled foam up over the back of it, and then I weighted the bend of the hook with just like stainless steel wire just so the fly rides true, and I
Yep.
I cut it down real tight, and it looks like a piece of white bread. Like Wonder himself would have baked it. And but it is so cool. You could, like, slap that fly, right? No need to be gentle with it. Slap it down in the water, and you'll see giant V-wakes, like as if a pike were coming after a topwater fly. And they just crush it. It is so much fun. But
slap it down like it's coming out of a four-year-old kid's hand.
Oh, my God, yes. It is so much fun. Like I said, we only do it at the end of one of our floats. And, yeah, it's just like the treat at the end of the float.
That is cool. Hey, man, I wouldn't be ashamed of that. Like, we trout fishermen, we have the mop fly. We have weenies. We have, you know, like, you got it. Like, the wiggle worm. You got the tan worm. Like, you can't be ashamed if you want to catch fish.
I think we should come up with a corn fly.
Yeah. You guys don't do that?
No.
Yellow sucker spawn. Come on.
I'm gonna start fishing some of these bigger fish because I gotta get away from those size 18s and 20 hooks. I can't see that shit.
So, Chad, I have a question for you about carp and it. So, is the vanilla extract really a thing? Does it work?
I think the guys that use the dough balls. I think that really is a thing. I never caught a carp on any gear except for that day before I started fly fishing only. That's the first carp I ever caught.
Really?
Yeah. So
I never like thrown a little bit of vanilla extract on a pheasant tail or something.
I have not done that. Not saying that I'm above it, but I haven't done it.
I'm not above anything really, but that's, so I have heard that works, but then I've heard it doesn't.
Carp are loaded with taste buds. They do. That's how they eat. They eat by taste and smell. They have taste buds on their eyelids. That's how really? Many taste buds they have. Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting.
They're insane fish, man.
They are. I agree with that. They are insane fish. Tip number three from Chad.
I'm just winging these as I go, guys.
That's okay. Because you're coming with a bonus tip too.
Okay. I will say, make sure you have a reel that has a good drag, because you're going to be seeing your backing with carp.
So disc drag.
Yeah, like I said, my reel doesn't have a good drag, but I'm fat, I'm bald, I'm blind, and I'm also not a quick learner. So. I do a lot of palming on my old Cabela's reel, but I got that rod. I use an 8-weight strictly for carp just because I like to get them in fast. But I got this 8-weight on my wedding anniversary or my honeymoon with my wife, and I can't see to replace it. So every big fish I caught has been on that rod, and I love it.
So need a good drag. I can attest to that, because when they go. I mean, they don't call them the bonefish of freshwater for nothing, right?
No, man. And they're big. You can catch carp up to 15 pounds.
Oh, yeah. We've got them that big here.
The biggest carp I ever caught was a 15-pounder out of a little bitty tributary to the Chenango River. And I was out smallie fishing with a 3-weight. And I saw this carp just feeding. I saw it. It was in its feeding lane. And every once in a while, it would shift over and eat something and then come back. So I sat and watched it for probably 5 minutes. I was like, I got to catch this fish. All I have is a 3-weight. Oh, well. So I bombed it. I made the cast just like, I don't know, 2 feet too far. That fish didn't care. It bombed that fly. Just boom. And then I ended up fighting it for like 20 minutes.
That's awesome. On a 3-weight.
On a 3-weight. But that's another thing. I don't mess around with light tippet on anything. Trout, or not trout, but smallmouth and carp, straight 17 pound test.
Yeah. Which is what?
I don't know if I've ever met a leader shad bass.
I don't think so either. In X.
Oh, in X, I'd be like, 0X, I think, is 15, isn't it? So
yeah, no, I think it's great. Yeah.
I just go to Walmart and buy the suffix. I like green. Yeah. But
yeah.
I don't know why, just from the bass fishing gear days. But yeah, I like green suffix and 17-pound test.
Yeah, and you can see it.
Not the fluorescent green, like the moss green.
They don't care.
No, they don't care one bit. what was that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have a hunting trip coming up that I'm actually going on in the fall time. I want some tips from you guys.
All right, let's, where are you going?
I am going to the eastern shore of Maryland to hunt sickadee.
Oh my God. Really?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, you want to hear my tip?
Yes.
Have you ever heard of the Meat Eater podcast?
I listened to it, and I listened to it religiously, and that's where I got the idea. And my cousin is married, or her husband has a farm in the Eastern Shore, and there's so many sick of deer. He ran over one with a combine last year while we were down there.
Wait! Don't be saying that on here. And then after we're done, we'll talk about this.
Okay. Should we cut that out?
Yeah. No. So the sickadeer, I think, I don't know a whole lot about sickadeer other than what, you know, I've never hunted them.
I haven't either, but I think they're fairly hard to hunt.
We're going to do like the Meat Eater did. We're going to split seasons. Our first 2 days are going to be the last 2 days of archery. And then the second 2 days are going to be the first 2 days of muzzleloader.
I think they're fairly responding to calls.
Okay.
I'm fairly sure that, and it's like a woo or something like that.
Well, can you do that again so I can record it? And then we'll.
Are you ready? When you're out there, I don't know if Maryland allows electronic calls or not, but.
Perfect.
Oh, my God. I think we should market that.
But I think, honestly, on
can you
his...
do it one more time?
I think
Christ.
On his that he names a guy that makes his own calls for sickadeer.
Okay.
Right? And I would go back and listen to that podcast because they were there twice. And I know the guy, like, the one guy was a deer biologist, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, tip-wise, I can't. I've been on the Delmarva, or near the Delmarva a lot.
Me too.
And
but not
you
hunting.
Can't, no, I've never hunted it, but I would say bring a lot of goddamn bug spray and wear some light clothes.
Yep.
It's just smoking hot.
Yeah,
and it's all... you're in the water, right? Like, it's all swamp stuff.
Yeah.
I think so. Like I said, I go down there every year, and we go crabbing, and I caught a cobia this year for the first time, but I never hunted.
No, I've never hunted around that, but I'll tell you what, there's some huge whitetails in that area, too.
I will give you a tip, all right?
Okay.
If you're going to go 2 weeks of archery and 2 weeks of rifle, right?
2 days of archery and 2 days of muzzleloader.
Okay, and you have a bow.
I do.
How often do you shoot your bow?
Okay, here's another weird thing. I don't hunt. We shoot archery league at a. We have a local archery shop here, Golden Grain. I'll give them a plug. But we shoot archery league out here from January till last week was our awards banquet, and my team came in first. So we shoot all right.
You shoot a 300 round?
No. Oh, what?
No. I mean, in a 300 round, what would you typically shoot?
I don't know what 300 round is. We shoot, 480s are top. We shoot animal leagues. So okay. 8s, 10s, and 5s. 480s the high, and I think my highest was a 4:15.
So you're in good shape.
You're better off shooting those. If you're going to shoot at animals anyway, you're better off doing that than a target anyhow.
So there are a few tips that I give give to people when they're first hunting archery, or even if they have been and they find out that they're really no good at it. And I'm not saying you're not any good at it.
Oh yeah.
I went to a single pin. It changed everything for me.
Okay. So you adjust it with a screw, like a screw setting.
Yeah. So there's just a dial and I adjust it that way. You know why that changed everything is because it made me think, you know, especially with those Sika deer, I think you have a long ways to, you can see them coming or even hear them coming from a long ways off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making that adjustment to where they're going to be and where you want to make that shot and not having all that clutter of those three or four pins in the way.
Okay, that's a great idea.
Yeah, so it changed the game for me. When I went from three or four pins down to one, that's when I started killing deer. But that also coincided with me really taking archery seriously, too. You know, so take that for what it's worth. Yeah. I'll never go back to...
What came first, the chicken or the egg, you know?
Right, exactly.
I will say I shoot back tension because I have target panic super bad with a trigger release.
So does Steve. It's not super bad. I have it.
Oh, no. Mine's horrible. Like, mine was the worst ever. Like, the worst. So
you hinge, right?
I shoot a stand now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
like a true back tension.
In that setting, I would, because you have a lot of time to think about it, I would just stick with that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Like I said, I haven't hunted in probably 5 years. Longer than that. I haven't shot a deer in 10 years.
Well, if that's what you're used to and you're confident with it, I wouldn't change.
How confident are you with it that you can make it go if you have to?
I don't know if I can make it go if I have to right now. You know what I mean?
Right.
I listened to, you guys had the archery guru on recently, and the way he was talking, he had a saying whenever he drew his bow, and that's what I went to, and it really helped. Mad Steve or Mad Jack or...
Average Jack Archery.
That's it. That was the dude.
And he knows his stuff. He really does. And listen, I'm telling you, if you feel comfortable with that, I would stick with it. And I don't know how comfortable, like, do you get excited when an animal comes in?
Oh, I always get excited, man. I wouldn't do it if I didn't get excited.
So that's a single pin, like, for me, like, that changed the game.
Okay.
For me. What do you think, Steve? You've been shooting a single pin for how many years now?
Oh, it definitely changed for me.
Cleared up that sight window.
I'm still not a huge fan of adjusting the yardage, but it sure beats trying to guess at the yardage. But, I mean, as far as, like, not guessing at the yardage, for me it was splitting pins. Yeah. So on a typical, like, 5-pin sight, or... some guys now are using 7 pins. Every yardage in between what you set is a different yardage. And by that, I mean, if you're setting your yardage at 10, 20, 30, 40, or 20, 30, 40, 50, the in-betweens are typically your 5 yards.
Yeah, you're going to split them.
You got to split them. So, right. Even if you're ranging a deer and it's at 33 yards, you're splitting your 20 and 30-yard pin. For the most part, I never liked splitting pins because I never thought I could focus on in between two pins.
I can't focus on. I have a hard enough time focusing on one pin, let alone
they both.
Five.
There's advantages and disadvantages to both.
I agree, but I'll never in my life go back to more than.
So when you guys are adjusting your dial, are you able to keep your eye on the deer and count clicks? Like, from where you are Or do you have to look down at your sight and take your eyes off the deer?
At it, but it literally takes like
milliseconds. Like it takes a second or two, and there's time. Everybody who says there isn't time,
there's not time. I disagree with you. There's times that you get surprised by an animal, and
because you're hanging out on your phone,
no.
Steve.
I'm not going to disagree that I use it in the woods. But there are banks. I haven't even.
No,
there's been times though that you always know that, like, typically a guy that has a single pin will run it at about 25 yards.
That's right.
That'll get you from
20 to
20 easily, and
no
maybe,
problem, and you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's when they get out farther that you need to be concerned with moving it.
And how often do you, especially now where he's going to hunt is a different story, but how often in Pennsylvania do you shoot longer than 30 yards? It's not very often.
Well, and you need to have, I think everybody needs to have a limit on themselves. If you tell yourself that you're completely confident at hitting, especially the deer he's going after.
50 yards is my limit.
They're way smaller than what we're typically hunting.
Oh, those are small deer.
So if you're
confident. And by the way, can I interrupt you for just a second?
No, you can't.
No.
That's what I do. I can't help it. I'm sorry. But
if you're comfortable at shooting at, you know you can make a kill shot at 40 yards, then set your limit at 40. Don't sit one out there at 50 and think, I can probably hit it. Now you can interrupt.
All right. Now I forgot what I was going to say.
Good. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, on that topic, I used to archery hunt very frequently, and I killed, I don't know, 5 or 6 deer, but I never made a shot over 20 yards. So
yeah.
I do know my range, and I do know how comfortable I am. And like I said, the deer I shot all those, or the bow I shot all those deer with, is the bow I'm still using now. This bow's old enough to drink. I take it to the bar with me afterwards. It's an old Hoyt Deviator, and it's every bit old enough to drink.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No,
they killed deer 21 years ago. That's going to kill a deer now, I guarantee it.
So yep. The reasons and I will shoot out to 50 yards is because we typically practice at 7.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And the further out you practice, the better off you're going
to
be.
Well, there's another tip for you. If that bow's fast enough to get out of longer distances, practice there. Even if you're not doing that great, take shots at 60 or 70 yards, and then
when
come
you
back and take shots at 20, you'll be absolutely amazed at how that tightens stuff up.
Yep.
And when you shoot at 70, how much does the wind affect an arrow at that distance?
Oh, it does. But how much do you take that into account? I never take that into account.
You don't?
When we're
maybe when we're practicing, but not in
a hunting situation.
Yeah, you never I never take wind into account.
No, because like I said, I set my limit at probably 40 yards, maybe 50.
50.
Just depends.
And then you're in the woods, so you have a bunch of wind breaks also.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes, so we're hunting out in wide open fields, we're sitting on field edges. It just depends on the situation. I don't typically think about the wind too much as far as arrow flight goes, though, when I'm hunting, just to be honest.
I never do. When we're practicing, and this is what we do, we play a few games to get better, right? So we hang out with our buddies, and we'll get like 3 or 4 or 5 of us together. We'll play a game. We'll play this game at,
70 or 80 yards.
And then you might take that wind a little bit into account, but it's not much.
No, and what we're trying to do there is if you feel like you're in competition with somebody like that, you really need to concentrate on that one shot at 70 yards. It
heightens your sense of awareness. It makes you
and your focus.
It makes you more focused. It's competition is good all around. It makes you a better at everything you do, it makes you better.
So what's your game? Are you guys hanging up one of the guy's shoes and trying to shoot him at 70 yards? You know?
This is what... Right.
We have a target. We have a deer target out at 70 yards, and depending on what section of the vitals you hit or deer you hit, you get this certain amount of points. So we each shoot 3 arrows at a time and add the points. Usually we play to like 21, and you'll get 3 for a heart shot, 2 for a liver shot. Something else that's just on the deer will get you 1. So it'll be the first one to 21.
And you can't go over.
Oh. Right, you can't go over.
So it's like the basketball game.
Yeah, basically.
And it makes you a better shooter. It does. Because you don't want to lose your buddy, right? It makes you focus. And it's just a fun game.
Heart shots at 70 yards or 80 yards are really, really hard. But it really makes you concentrate on that point of you put your pin on a point, just like you're doing on a live animal. You set your pin in on a spot. You pick a spot there, and you try to hold that pin and squeeze that off. It really, when you're trying to score points, it makes you concentrate.
And it can... There are times where we'll have maybe there's not, let's say there's 3 of us shooting. There might be 6 arrows out of the 9 that are in the heart area, right?
Around it, yeah.
Yeah. So that, and then we're talking a 3.5 inch.
It breeds confidence is what it does.
Yep.
If if you can hit something around there. And like I said, even if you're not doing that well there, and then you walk it back, you go back to start shooting 30 yards, banging arrows together because it's, yeah.
So at 70 yards, you're just trying to knock your buddy's knock off, basically. I love breaking my partner's knocks and stuff at archery league. That's half the fun.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the competition and the fun of that is that you're like, yep, I just cost you $10 right there.
Well, you're not knocking your buddies knocked off at 70 yards.
No, but...
But it's by you're chance. Trying to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, the heart in your target, is it about the size of a balled-up fist?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
Okay. That's a pretty damn good shot.
Well, we're not always hitting it.
I know, but aiming at it, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So it's fun. It makes you better.
Well, that's also what that single pin does. So it opens up your whole sight picture. So instead of a whole circle full of this mess that you have in front of you, you can actually see that single pin just sitting on that.
That's a good.
That fist-sized heart, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas out that far, if you've got 5 or 7 pins in that sight window, you've got a lot
anything.
Of shit in there because it's all just a, you know what I mean? It's just filling that up, and it's a mess.
And with your single pin, are you guys using magnifiers at all, or are you just shooting it open like a normal?
I do during when we're shooting in the league, but. Other than that, I tried to use it for hunting, and last year it almost cost me.
Why is that?
What happened was it was dark, and it was too. The deer was. I just couldn't make the. I couldn't make the differentiation between because it was so magnified. I couldn't make the differentiation between. The crease, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the crease in it. So I probably won't do that anymore.
And you think without magnification, it'll be clearer for you to see?
Yes. Yeah, especially at 25, anywhere between 20 and 30 yards, yeah, I think it's clear.
Well, with any kind of glass or any kind of scope or anything like that, you've got the issues of fogging up. And if it happens to be raining or misting, you've got that issue of rain droplets on there. just.
Oh, remember, yeah, guys, I'm. Yeah. Remember, I'm bald. I have to wear glasses all the time. I know about fog. Do you guys fish with buffs on at all?
Yeah.
Do you wear buffs?
What's that?
Do you guys wear buffs when you fish?
No, never.
See, I wear them around my neck mainly. But, like, if it is sunny and my nose is starting to get burned, I'll pull it up. And then that's when my glasses start to fog.
Sunscreen's an amazing thing.
It is. Then my hands get sticky and... I used to roof. I roofed for 10 years and never wore sunscreen once, which was a stupid idea, but it's because I didn't like the dirt stick to me.
Yeah.
So.
I've often wondered about those. Do they work well?
They do help keep bugs off. I will say that much. And I.
What about? They help cool or not?
I'm sorry, you broke up for just a second.
Do they cool you down enough? Like, do they keep the sun off you enough to keep you cool too, or just?
They keep the sun off you enough. I wouldn't say they cool you down. They're kind of a pain in the ass, but
yeah,
like I said, it's something it helps like protect your ears and your neck, and if you don't want the sunscreen on your hands, basically. So that's really the only reason for them.
Okay, so. I'll say this, Chad. Let's say you put the sunscreen on and you've got it on your hands. You're standing in water. Rinse it off. That's what I like.
You guys don't fish. You guys don't fish in the filthy water like we do.
Yeah.
Remember, I'm chasing carp, man. It's in slimy, muddy, mucky mess.
It is. Did you give us your last tip? The bonus tip.
You always have to stay hydrated when you're carp fishing, and PBR is the best form of hydration for carp fishing.
Oh my God.
Got to keep it classy.
You and Turkey would get along really well. How old are you, Chad?
I am 35.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's it. You're right in that PBR era.
You know what? I started drinking it before the hipsters did.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good one. My God.
My mom's not listening to this, so I started drinking it when I was like 16. So it was way before the hipsters.
That's right. Before it was even cool.
Yeah.
So, Chad, do you drink craft beer at all?
I do. I drink a lot of craft beer, but... The quantity of beer I drink, I have to subsidize it with crap beer. Like I said, I was drinking lukewarm High Lifes during this podcast because.
All right, yeah. Let's hear your favorite craft beer.
My favorite craft beers are I like the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale only because it's an original, you know. It's what started me out on the hoppier flavors.
Yep.
There's a brewery that started in Cleveland. It's called Platform. They make some of the best sours and IPAs that I've ever had. I love Platform beer, and they are opening another brewery in Pittsburgh. So you Yenzers are going to be able to get it here pretty soon. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, there's another brewery in Edinburgh, PA. It's a small podunk town that has no stoplights and one stop sign. But it's called Crooked Tongue Brewery, and they make some great hazy IPAs. I don't know the name of any of their beers, but their hazy IPAs are off the chain.
That's a lot like Brew Gentlemen.
Yeah. Have you been there? Have you been to Brew Gentlemen?
I have not. My Pittsburgh brewery tour has been limited. We've hung out in Millville a little bit. I went to a Lucero concert, and my memory of that night was pretty foggy. But there's a brewery down there that was really good. I forget the name of it.
So I would suggest going to next time you're in Pittsburgh, you got to stop at Church Brewers. It's just because of the atmosphere. It's really cool, right?
Okay, I've ran past the Church Brew Works only because my wife has done the Pittsburgh Marathon the last 2 years. And I think it's in the route. And I've ran past it trying to keep up like with her and yell for her, hey, go, baby, go! And
right.
But I've never actually got to stop in.
And then, but if you're in the area, our buddy, well, Greg listens to the podcast. He got us into Brew Gentlemen, and then once he actually sent us some stuff, and then we stopped in there. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I've been in a couple times.
So what do they specialize in? Are they the IPAs? Are they like a stout factory?
Yeah, and a lot of their stuff's the hazy stuff too, like the New England Stout or whatever.
Oh, the Haze Bros.
Yeah. Yep. And if you're into a sour, I mean, you go down to Pizza Boy, right?
I'll tell you who else is sour. Ithaca makes.
That's true.
So can I give another crap beer suggestion?
Yeah.
Don't get offended, but Natural Light started making Natter Day.
Oh my god!
Are you serious it is right now. It is so good.
You can't bring Natty Light into this.
It is so good.
Go ahead.
And you can't take yourself too seriously while you're drinking it because it's in a pink can with flamingos on it.
What's it called?
Natter Day.
Natter Day.
It's a strawberry lemonade beer. It doesn't taste like beer at all. It tastes like a Arnold Palmer's that Arizona tea makes.
Yeah.
But it's like 5%, so it does the job, and it's fun. And it's funny. It's a great conversation starter when you're out with people. Like, what the hell is that? What's that pink beer? You know?
Hey, Chad, we're not opposed to anything at all.
Nope.
Like, if that's what that's fine with us. We're completely open. Look, everybody, Steve and I don't like a lot of the same beers.
Look, I'm a closet Bud Light orange drinker.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Sometimes I just...
Hey.
You heard it first.
Don't worry, Steve. My wife had one of those at the bar the other night.
There you go.
I don't mind it.
All right, Chad. Well, hey, man, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. This has been great.
Yeah, we're going to have to do this again.
Oh,
I
agree. I'm always open for this. This is fun.
From your end, like you got four guys on your end, right?
Yeah, we have four guys. So if we get you two guys, shoot, we could do this all night.
That's, oh, my God.
I agree.
I agree.
We got one guy in here who's a pinner. We just keep him around. I don't know why.
Really?
He's a mutt. But like I said, we take all kinds.
Pinners still are around?
Yes. Believe it or not. We've been slowly trying to convert him. He does a smallmouth with a fly, and he does the hybrids with a fly. He won't come out carp fishing, but his main thing is going up and catching steelhead on the pin rod.
Nice,
but he doesn't do it like the conventional pinners though. He does a float and a jig, and he'll pop the jig and work the jig like a lure. So I give him that much. I don't know. It's still kind of gay.
Hey, Chad, thanks for coming on, man. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, thanks. It's been my pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, later, bro.
Hey, Chad.